Next up on This Week in Law, we've got Baron Soka and John Hickey joining us from Tech Freedom. We're going to go deep on the Netflix deal with Comcast, on the Comcast-Time Warner merger, on the scope of power of the FCC, on reclassification of broadband, and on being kind to puppies and kittens, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWIL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 248, recorded February 28, 2014. A rock and a hard connection. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law, where we look at the latest and most important developments in the fields of legal, technology, law, and policy. Not legal technology law and policy, but technology law and policy. And we'll get into the nuances of what we mean by that, I think, in this show. We've been having really propitious scheduling luck lately. We were able to have an antitrust guru on last week to discuss the Time Warner and Comcast merger. And this week, we've got a couple of great folks from Tech Freedom who pay very close attention to issues like net neutrality and mergers of large cable companies. Lots that has been in the news lately that folks have been struggling mightily to understand. We're very, very fortunate to have two experts in that field with us today. The president of Tech Freedom is Baron Soka, and he's with us here today. Hello, Baron.
Hi, thanks, Denise.
It's great to have you back on the show. Also joining us is Tech Freedom's strategic director, John Hinkey. Hello, John.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Why don't we start out? Tech Freedom has been around for a while. I tend to associate it, although probably not correctly, with the Tech Liberation Front, where I know Baron blogs. Can you guys give us just a brief history of your organization and why you do what you do?
Yeah, sure, Denise. So I practiced internet communications law until 2008 and had always planned to go back into the think tank world. I had been doing that in college and law school. So I joined first the Progress and Freedom Foundation, and then PFF closed in 2010. And Tech Freedom started up at the beginning of 2011 to pick up where PFF left off, and frankly, the better parts of PFF, the things that really the free market movement had not been doing for a long time, like specifically for a variety of reasons. Some of the folks who were there in during the Bush administration sat by and said nothing while AT&T was compelled to let the NSA surveil communications out in San Francisco. So we cover a wide range of issues, dealing with NSA surveillance to ensuring that Americans have protection from law enforcement agencies who might track their cell phone or seize their cell phone on arrest. You know, so all those issues, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, as well as telecom issues like net neutrality, as well as competition issues, as well as consumer protection. So it's the full range of internet policy. We don't, however, tend to get involved in the very complicated issue of copyright and patents. We've done a little bit on that. We were out in front with our concerns about SOPA, which we saw as a really an internet regulation bill more than a copyright bill. But that's what we cover, and I hope we'll get to chat about a lot of those issues today.
We will indeed. And we've had Jeff Mann from Tech Freedom on the show as well. And the Tech Liberation Front, I'm remembering from way back in the early days of blogging, Baron, back when Glenn Reynolds was sort of, well, you know, it as though he's not still quite a heavy hitter in the blogging world. But back in the day, he was quite something. And I think he used to write there as well, didn't he?
No, but he may have retweeted some of our, or shared some of our content. That's just a group blog for free market or libertarian-minded technology policy folks.
Gotcha. All right. So I don't often give our audience homework or supplemental work to do, you know, in conjunction with the show. But this week I'm going to, because on Wednesday's episode of This Week in Google, there was a great net neutrality discussion with Dan Rayburn of streamingmedia.org. And it went very much into sort of the intricacies of peering and transit and how all these things work technologically all around the story that came out early this week that Netflix is entering into a direct agreement with Comcast to be able to ensure the quality of Netflix carriage by Comcast, the quality of what's delivered to Comcast customers when they go to Netflix. So this has triggered a whole bunch of discussion and speculation, and Dan did a very nice job of debunking some myths and talking about, you know, who is what, who all the players are and what they do in this very intricate dance. So I encourage you to go check that out if you have not already, if you're not one of the folks who listens to every single one of the Twit shows. That's a good compliment to what we're going to do here today, which is hopefully get into not just the technology, but the law and policy ramifications of this deal, if there are any. So I know, and I've been eating my Wheaties and definitely training hard this week, guys, because I've been trying to keep up with, in some way anyway, both of your Twitter feeds. And that is a Herculean task. You guys are very voluble on Twitter and go back and forth and have great insights there. It's pretty amazing what you're able to accomplish and the discussions you can have in 140 characters.
Well, I was mainly going for snark, so I'm glad you found some insights.
Yes, definitely found some great insights. Found some great snark too. John, you had something that I retweeted that I just loved. If I can find it here, hold on. It was just yesterday. Hypothetically, if a Muslim baker refuses to serve a gay illegal immigrant, should we all just take a sabbatical from Twitter? Which I thought was just classic. My point in bringing up the Twitter chatter is that definitely there are a lot of issues and a lot of nuances to this deal between Comcast and Netflix, which is causing a lot of hand-wringing among folks who, you know, see this coming hard on the heels of the decision against the FCC and in favor of Verizon by the D.C. Circuit, where the open internet rules that the FCC had promulgated were tossed out. I think that the perhaps a media tendency here has been for people to go, okay, open internet's out. Comcast, by the way, did agree to abide by the open internet rules, even though they've been tossed out. And maybe we can discuss that a bit. But I think the tendency has been to say, okay, no open internet here. We have the first, you know, agreement where someone's going to get preferential treatment for their traffic. But I have the feeling that both of you would characterize this otherwise. Why don't we start with you, Baron, and tell us what you think of this Comcast-Netflix arrangement.
Sure. Well, let's just start by putting a few things on the table. First of all, there's a common misconception that this deal, the Comcast-Time Warner Cable deal, changes broadband competition at all. It doesn't. They don't compete with each other. So they have cable franchises in different areas. So all we're talking about here is Comcast is going to have more cable systems. It doesn't change broadband competition. So that's the first thing. The concerns about the deal are, in that sense, they're not what economists would call horizontal competition concerns. They're really about vertical effects, how Comcast might deal with either cable programmers or with an alternative to cable like Netflix. And I think we can talk about this. I think that those concerns are either already dealt with by the NBC Universal merger conditions. Comcast bought NBC Universal. They agreed to a number of conditions specifically to protect online video. We could talk about some of those. Or there are concerns that are dealt with by existing FCC rules or that the FCC can police quite well. And to the extent that people are concerned about broadband in this deal, and that what they're really pissed off about is that they want more broadband options. This deal doesn't change that. If anything, that's what we should be talking about. And the problem there isn't cable companies, it's local governments making it very difficult to build out new broadband networks. And I'm all in favor of changing that to make sure there is more competition. Just two other things. The other reason that people have been very concerned about this deal is that they see their cable bill going up overall. And so they assume that something's wrong with the cable companies. But the reality is that cable bills are going up because cable programming costs are going up. And so and that's for a variety of reasons. Part of it is there's a lot more money going into programming. There's a lot of great programming on TV today. I think it's true. We live in a golden age of cable television. But the bottom line is that if there is market power here, it's really the content owners. It's HBO and especially the sports networks and other programmers who are getting more money for their content. Those are the companies that drive up cable costs. Those are the companies that in many cases don't want to put their content online because they're not sure how they'll make money on it. And we can talk about those problems, but those aren't problems to do with cable or systems or broadband as such. And then the other thing I would just say to set the table is there's a real misunderstanding of the D.C. Circuit decision. People think that the FCC lost and that somehow this changes the open internet. The reality is what actually happened is the D.C. Circuit struck down two of the rules that the FCC put in place in 2010. That doesn't really change much because at the same time, the D.C. Circuit said that the FCC has broad authority to regulate really anything, not just net neutrality, not even just broadband, but anything on the internet, any form of communications, basically so long as it doesn't impose common carriage. So there are some kinds of economic restrictions that the FCC can't impose, but the FCC can, through this provision, section 706, the FCC can require, for example, that any deals struck are reasonable and non-discriminatory. And that power applies both to net neutrality, as the FCC defined it originally, which was network management, which is inside the network, but also to the deals that you referenced. So the Netflix deal that's just been announced, that is not something that would have been covered anyway by the net neutrality rules. That's a different level of the internet. That's about what happens outside of Comcast network and how Comcast interacts with Netflix or other companies that provide peering or interconnection services. But those are the debates, and the short version is the FCC has a lot of power, and the question is how should they use it? What should the standards be? And that's what the FCC has asked in the rulemaking that they're apparently about to start.
Right. They have a public comment open right now and are investigating what the next move is going to be. What the next move is not going to be, Tom Wheeler announced last week, is an appeal of the Verizon FCC decision. So the Supreme Court won't be asked to get involved here. Did that surprise you, John?
No, not really. These are going to be fought at the political and lower court level for the time being.
Okay. Do you think that, as Barron was saying, because the FCC was had some authority confirmed that might have been at issue before this decision, that they'd like to see that stand and might not want the Supreme Court to come in and disagree?
Right. Well, they're going to they got enough in this ruling that they can do what they want to accomplish, or they don't really want to spend a lot more time in court. I mean, Wheeler is perfectly aware that Jenikowski spent a very substantial portion of his term in court and all of his term dealing with an issue that wasn't necessarily an issue that needed to be dealt with, or certainly wasn't an issue that needed to be a top priority. So I think that they got enough that they don't feel the need to take this and make an all or nothing gamble on the Supreme Court. Or
yeah, I would just add to that.
Continue fighting it.
Go ahead, Barron.
I would just add to that, Denise, that again, I can't underscore strongly enough how broad the power that the D.C. Circuit gave the FCC under Section 706 is. It is a power. It's for many years, many people, including copyright skeptics, especially like Public Knowledge and the Electronic Frontier Foundation, have worried about the FCC using what it calls ancillary jurisdiction to claim that it can regulate something like copyright policing. And to make a long story short, this new power, 706, is like that power, except it's easier to exercise. The FCC will essentially probably always win when they try to do it, so long as they don't violate some specific protection or prohibition in the Communications Act. And most troublingly, the 706 power doesn't even require rulemaking. It could be used really to cajole companies to voluntarily do something, voluntarily in quotes, or it could be used to just do a declaratory ruling saying that something is not appropriate. And that could be anything from mandating copyright enforcement to imposing regulations on app stores or on smart home devices, or potentially in a Republican administration, you could see the FCC trying to clean up the internet using Section 706. It's really quite disturbing. And so you're seeing, ironically, a lot of people across the political spectrum from a variety of philosophical points of view saying that whatever they think of what happened on net neutrality, that 706 is a very serious problem.
Evan, last week on the show, you talked more about the antitrust ramifications of the Time Warner Comcast merger. Is there any of that discussion where we had Ryan Radia and Spencer Weber Waller and Lisa Brodkin with you that comes to mind here and that shades our discussion now?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've got to admit this discussion is pretty esoteric. We've got, you know, the wonderful experts here on all of this here today. But I think that the probably the biggest picture or the biggest relevance of it all is just the way that the marketplace would be shifting here. And, if Comcast and Time Warner end up as one big company, I think it's pretty unclear what the real, or at least to a layperson, somebody, an observer from the outside, what the real effect is going to be to the consumer. So, you know, I defer to the real smart experts on most of these issues to get into the real nuances of the particular issues that would arise, kind of the cause and effect, the relationship between one to the other.
Okay, well, one nuance Barron just brought up, and that is that this Netflix deal or other deals that Netflix may be engaged in striking with other ISPs, which have certainly been rumored or alluded to this week as well, that doesn't really impact net neutrality, that occurs at a different layer of the internet. Could you expand on that for us, Barron?
Yeah, so there's a misconception out there today that Netflix doesn't have to pay for capacity, and that Comcast is for the first time trying to shake down Netflix. That's just not true. Netflix has to pay today, or has in the past had to figure out at enormous expense to Netflix. That's a lot of what your Netflix monthly subscription goes to. They've had to build their own content delivery network and had to figure out how to get traffic across the internet, and that means striking deals with companies like, say, Cogent or Level 3. What just happened was Comcast offered them a more cost-effective option to route traffic directly to Comcast Network. So what we're talking about here is really Comcast offering a way to Netflix to be able to improve the quality of Netflix streaming for Comcast customers at a price that was lower than what Comcast was paying for other ways of getting that traffic through. So when you really look down at it, and this is the point that that streaming media post that you shared really makes clear, when you really look at it, people are upset about net neutrality, and it's a sensitive topic, but there really isn't a problem here. This is the market working. And if there is a problem, that's something that the antitrust laws deal with, the FCC has plenty of power to deal with, and that importantly is checked. You know, any price that Comcast can charge, there's a ceiling on that because, one, Comcast isn't the only option. Netflix can always find other providers to carry that traffic to Comcast. Even if Netflix couldn't and Comcast found a way of trying to charge all providers more, it's also true that people don't like to admit this, but Comcast does face competition. So 15% today of Comcast customers can switch to Verizon Fiber, which is a faster product in most markets. And that doesn't sound like a lot to some folks. And it certainly could be higher, and I want it to be higher. And I'm looking forward to Google Fiber rolling out and AT&T's rolling out a 45 megabit per second service for the 25% of Comcast customers where AT&T competes. But the point is just whether it's 15% or 40%, as long as there is a significant percentage of Comcast customers that can switch to a fast service or a faster service, Comcast has a strong incentive to make sure that their entire system, both those customers and everybody else, can get Netflix at a streaming rate that works for them, because if they don't, they'll switch. So we could talk about how to increase competition here, but there is actually already a fair amount of broadband competition that disciplines that side of the market, even if it doesn't mean that everyone has a choice of some other provider than Comcast.
IRC is pointing out to me, I was so enthusiastic to get into this discussion today, I neglected to introduce Evan Brown, my co-host, who is with us in Chicago, Illinois today, although he's already jumped into the discussion. Evan's with the Info Law Group and is always on the show. So if you're not a regular listener, here's Evan. And so good to see you again. And thank you so much for steering the ship last week.
Hey, thank you. It was my pleasure. And of course, it's good to be here. Let's keep on rolling.
All right. Hey, John, is there some kind of a fox in the hen house issue that people should be paying attention or regulators should be paying attention to here, having to do with the notion that people, institutions, organizations like Comcast provide both internet access and cable TV access, and that companies like Netflix might, you know, deal with the one side of the business, but compete with the other?
Well, there's certainly an anti-competitive concern, and, mm-hmm. and that's why we have laws and agencies that deal with it. And to the extent that those could be a problem, that's the proper place to deal with that. I don't believe it's a substantial net neutrality issue, at least not as distinct from the antitrust and competitive practices issue. The thing is, those markets are incredibly, incredibly complex. So anytime you talk about the interplay between players in that market, you're going to see degrees of competition, degrees of cooperation between all of the players. And I think it's a bit of an oversimplification to just simply say they have an incentive to stop it, therefore they're going to stop it. Because a lot of the other players mm-hmm. in the market have a tremendous amount of leverage. Tim Wu, the fellow who created the name Net Neutrality, wrote a New Yorker article last year where he pointed out that in the early days of the debate, the ISPs had the leverage in the market. Now, many of the edge providers like Netflix, like Google, like Facebook, they have the leverage in the market. So perhaps we should look at, and I'm paraphrasing him here, but perhaps we should look at regulating them instead of or in addition to. And that's one of the problems with the net neutrality debate. You can always find another step that is necessary to accomplish the purpose if your goal or if your starting premise is that we need to eliminate the incentive to discriminate in some way. I mean, some of the discrimination, Netflix in particular, is simply geographic. There was an article a number of years ago in the Wall Street Journal that Google wants to buy a fast lane on the internet. And it was suggesting that Google's buying co-location from content providers, putting their servers inside the local networks of internet service providers, was a violation of net neutrality. But it wasn't. It was simply buying geographic access, which has been going on for probably as long as the internet has been around. It has been a common, very, very normal practice. That's the whole business model of Akamai. So to some extent, what Netflix is doing is simply saying, we're going to pay you directly so that we can get really close to your customers instead of paying somebody else to deliver it, and then we have to compete with the rest of their traffic. It is very easy to make an argument that there is an incentive, and yet there is very rarely much direct evidence of this in actual practice on the internet.
Okay, so from a regulatory and policy standpoint, What we want to see happen is competition. We want to see consumers treated fairly. We want to see a good deal of incentive for pricing to be competitive. I guess that's the first point I mentioned. And we want to see efficiency. As we try and unravel what's going on with this Comcast Netflix deal, it seems like the latter point, efficiency, is kind of a mess. It seems to me that, you know, the market is battling it out with the various transit and peering arrangements that are in place here. But that, as I say, it's kind of a mess. I mean, is this what we want to encourage, Baron?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean when you say it's a mess. That if the back end of the internet looks messy, it's because the internet wasn't designed to carry video. I mean, if you really step back and think about it, think about the the old days when video first started being carried. Obviously, it was the porn industry, as with every other part of the internet, where they drove this forward. They figured out, you know, how to build the back end networks, and over time, you saw companies like YouTube and then eventually Netflix come online, and they had to fundamentally change the back end, where it was no longer the case that you had networks, Comcast network, Time Warner Cable's network, exchanging roughly equal amounts of traffic with each other. All of a sudden today, and I think you mentioned this in the lead up to the show, today the web, HTTP and HTTPS, is only about 12% of internet traffic. So over half of traffic on the internet is video. And what it's requiring to do that on the back end is an enormous amount of infrastructure. You could have the fastest connection to your house, Google Fiber, for example, right? 1,000 megabit per second service in theory. And you know how fast they stream Netflix? 3.6 megabits per second is the average streaming rate, which is faster than cable, but it's not that much faster. It's, you know, maybe it's twice as fast as the average rate for some other cable systems. The point is, it's really on the back end that you have this need for net capacity. And the net capacity problem has always been solved by contract, by private parties figuring out how to put money into that backbone. And Netflix has already had to pay for that. The question now is just, how does that interconnection market work? I don't see any problem yet, but as John points out, we have laws that deal with that. Antitrust law is perfectly capable of dealing with that. And if it's not, the FCC has much broader power today than I would like them to have under Section 706 to police those deals. They can require, as they did with data roaming, where they said every wireless carrier essentially has to provide data roaming to its competitors' customers, provided that the two companies can negotiate on an individualized basis and make sure that they can work out a deal that makes sense. The FCC, though, can require, as I said before, that the terms be reasonable and non-discriminatory. So the point is, there are plenty of layers of legal protection here to govern that market. I don't see a problem, and I don't see it fundamentally changed by the Time Warner Cable Comcast merger either. And if it were, you could have conditions that specifically deal with that. And I just will also point out that a bigger company, it's easier to make an antitrust case against them. So if that were a problem, you can make that case. And antitrust law generally works best when it works in the background to ensure that companies don't engage in anti-competitive behavior in the first place. But nobody's really shown that market is failing.
So you mentioned Tim Wu, professor at Columbia Law School. He is reported to have this great sort of Wild West metaphor about what's going on at the FCC right now. He says, Tom Wheeler has stood up and walked through town like the sheriff and said, okay, the rules are still on. And whether he's shooting blanks or bullets isn't clear yet, but he's on the beat. So clearly, the FCC is going to make another move on the net neutrality front with the open internet rules struck down. It does not, consensus does not seem to be that that move is going to be to reclassify broadband as a common carrier. And I wanted to get your guys' thoughts on that. But first, before we get to that, what do you think the move is going to be? What's net neutrality from the FCC going to look like, as far as you can tell, as they're gathering public comment now? John? Can we start with John?
Sure. So, look, I think it's important to remind people that Netflix, as sort of the most prominent example of who might suffer in a non-neutral world, issued a report recently that said, we don't think net neutrality is going to be a problem. And that's certainly while they would have been negotiating with Comcast for direct access. So this is not something that many of the stakeholders, I should say, many of the people who are involved in the debate publicly are a little bit more worried than the people who are actually stakeholders who might be the victims in some of these cases. Google, I think, gave a good description a few years ago of where we stand. Rick Witt said at a conference, we know there are many non-neutral structures and business activities taking place every day on the net, which is fine. The point is the net is a robustly competitive place, and those kind of non-neutral activities are acceptable in that context. The concern around broadband is because it's a relatively scarce supply. The concerns there are heightened. But it's about outcome, not the path. And he went on to say that you can have a network neutrality environment without regulation to get you there. And in fact, I would submit, he said, that we actually have net neutrality right now. And so it's about the outcome, the environment. There are lots of mechanisms, whether it is the FCC's implied threat, whether it is the FTC and DOJ, whether it is competition. There are many ways to preserve the neutral environment without Rob Atkinson from ITIF called the lazy way of just a blanket law against discrimination without trying to figure out what is good, what is bad, what are healthy business deals, productive business deals. So as far as what the FCC might do, it seems like Wheeler is going to come out with a new set of general rules that will be allowed under the 706 authority they have. The extent to which those dive beyond the last mile that net neutrality was ostensibly supposed to be about, I think everybody's waiting to see.
Barron, what do you think?
Well, we don't exactly know what Wheeler is going to propose because they don't technically have the notice out yet. All we have seen thus far is Wheeler put out a statement outlining what he, the broad outlines of what he intends to propose to his fellow commissioners. So just to set the table here, what I think is going to happen is at some point soon in the next few weeks or the next month or two, you'll probably see the FCC release this notice of inquiry or notice of proposed rulemaking that will ask a bunch of questions about how best to deal with net neutrality, as well as broadband deployment and peering and these other sorts of issues that we've been talking about. What should happen is that initially, that'll be a notice of inquiry asking questions, and then the commission will actually propose rules, and then there'll be a second round of comments on those, and then we'll see final rules. And that process, I think, will play out probably over the next 9 to 12 months. That's going to be the same time period, roughly, as the Time Warner Cable Comcast merger. As to what the rules look like, I think it's also worth noting here, to the extent that people claim that the sky was falling, that while the court did strike down both the non-discrimination and blocking rules in the 2010 Open Internet Order, it's actually pretty clear if you read the court's decision that they wouldn't necessarily have struck down the no blocking rule if the FCC had argued its case better. So One of the things that people kind of missed here is that this case took 2 years to finally get to the point where it did. And that's very unusual. The court, for reasons we don't understand, delayed it from their calendar last year and pushed it forward to this year. And one of the consequences of that was that in the interim, so after the briefs were filed in the summer of 2012, the D.C. Circuit handed down that data roaming decision I mentioned. And so what the court really should have done, or what the FCC should have asked for, was to better brief the two most important issues, which were Section 706, what does it mean, and then the issue of common carriage, like where is the line. And if they'd done that, I think you probably would have seen the court uphold the no locking rule. And this is just to say that these are the same questions that the agency is going to be asking now in rulemaking. And probably end up seeing some form of both rules re-promulgated and upheld by the court. And it's entirely possible this time the FCC will go broader and will issue rules that govern peering and so on. But as I said, under 706, they don't have to issue rules at all. They can apparently use 706 on a case-by-case basis. So people need to understand that regulation with a lowercase r doesn't always mean formal rulemakings. It can be the threat of a declaratory ruling that comes one day or case-by-case action. It can just be the chairman making a bunch of companies sit down and work something out the way he did with cell phone unlock.
Evan, I have so many questions for these guys. I'm just going to keep firing them off, but I'll let you, you know, I don't want to usurp your ability to comment or ask questions too. Anything on your mind that you need to jump in with?
Well, John, I wanted to pick up on something that you said about Netflix not being concerned about network neutrality. And I'm wondering if, from a certain perspective, Netflix may stand to benefit from a non-neutral internet because it actually has the resources to enter into these peering arrangements with companies like Comcast. And I know that we've tried pretty hard on the conversation to separate the issues here of network neutrality and what's going on with Comcast and Netflix here. But it seems like it's plausible that a large-scale participant, edge provider, content producer with House of Cards and all that stuff, Netflix here, would benefit from an environment where there was no framework of network neutrality because it does indeed have the resources to make life okay for itself by entering into arrangements like this with Comcast. What do you think of something, some notion like that?
Well, so there is a valid argument that one could construct in hypothetical where unfortunate negative outcomes, where bad outcomes results from a certain set of rules. But that's really true with just about any set of rules. I mean, if you do ban some sort of prioritization or access, who's going to have the advantage? Only companies who can afford to spend billions of dollars or enormous hundreds of millions of dollars building their own private networks, getting access to Akamai, or companies with this scale to distribute their content more effectively. So no matter which scenario you construct, you could certainly imagine an outcome where a company like Google or a company like Netflix can game the system for its advantage. I'm going to mess this up, but you know the saying I've always had is the law and its majesty allows rich and poor alike to build a multi-billion dollar fast lane alongside the internet. That's certainly possible, but if you eliminate the ability or if you really dramatically limit the things that can happen within networks, I think you're going to see the large companies game the rules for their advantage anyway. So I guess my response back to you would be to say, can you construct a scenario where nobody can gain an advantage?
Let me jump in here and just add that people often compare net neutrality or non-neutral arrangements to payola. In the old days, you used to be possible to pay DJs to play your song on the radio. And it's actually a pretty good analogy, but not for the reasons that they imagine. Everyone seems to think that payola was a tool that the big labels used to control the media landscape in the 1950s and 1960s. And actually, the opposite is true. The big company actually tried to put an end to payola because paying for airtime was a way that new artists and small labels could break through. So people just don't really think carefully about the economics. They assume that a level playing field is always good for small guys, and that's not necessarily true and often very clearly not the case. It's also just one more thing just to point out here. People, when they talk about net neutrality, there's a concern sometimes that we're talking about, you know, every website on the internet and small guys not being able to compete. What we've always been talking about here is video platforms. That's where you need the capacity. And the question is there an ability for Netflix or Vimeo or Hulu or YouTube to get content to users? Within those platforms, small guys, YouTube is the most open platform you could want. Any small guy can stop. So it's really hard to see how if YouTube can strike a deal, Google's perfectly capable of negotiating with internet companies. And then all of us can take advantage of that because that's what we use, or we use Skype to distribute video. It's just not the case that, you know, we're going to have a million different video platforms on the internet and they all need to figure out this problem.
Yeah, let me jump in to make one more quick point regarding Barron's point about Plugola. I worked in radio for many years, and Plugola and Payola were bands. But the fact was, with those bands, the large record labels were able to get to spend a lot more time in front of the radio stations to provide a lot more things that were perfectly legal to provide, you know, boxes of CDs or trips to see artists. They had the scale, even if their payola itself was outlawed. And to the point about CDNs or peering, let me quote something that Public Knowledge said back in 2010. Content providers enter into paid peering arrangements with broadband access providers or use content delivery networks. These arrangements do not raise net neutrality concerns because they involve co-location of facilities and other means to reduce the distance a communication must travel rather than selling prioritized access to scarce bandwidth. If there are competitive concerns with these arrangements, for example, a broadband access provider might agree to peer with one content provider but not another on equal terms, competition law would probably suffice to address them. So there are valid potential problems with things like this, but the paid peering or CDNs are simply not a net neutrality issue.
It still seems like it's trying to circumvent a network neutrality issue. Sure, it's not a network neutrality issue because you're not really involving the network as much because you've just peered directly with it. And that's going back to my original question. It's only the Netflixes of the world who could strike a deal with Comcast, not some startup. But yeah, Baron, I like what you said, Evan. Then, I mean,
okay.
With Payola, it's really the other way around. That benefited the small guys more. I hadn't really thought about
and,
that.
And the thing here,
right? But if we bring this to you know, the small guy on the internet example, as opposed to the small record label or artist trying to pay off the radio station, that just means that operating budgets are perhaps going to have to be rejiggered. And, you know, in the same way that a company might decide to plunk down a bunch of money for a Super Bowl ad, maybe they would decide it was a good investment to, you know, find the money, whatever they can, to enter into an agreement that gets them wider distribution. Is that what you're alluding to, Baron?
Well, it's hard to see who besides video distributors at this point is going to actually feel the need to pay for a quality kind of arrangement, right? We could imagine maybe other scenarios, but right now we're talking about video providers. And my point is that number one, small content creators, you know, your show uses Skype. You don't set up your own distribution network, and whatever you use to stream on the internet, you know, I assume you're using, you know, a third party platform, whether it's YouTube or some other service. The point is, the video internet is different in significant ways from the World Wide Web. The World Wide Web, while it has big platforms like WordPress and Tumblr and Facebook and so on that might host websites, you know, I understand the concern. People want to be able to put up their own site, and they want to make sure that you know they're not really discriminated against significantly. But the difference with video, everyone's already using big video distribution platforms. So the question, the level of analysis is not really, does every video content creator, are they affected by this directly or not? What the real effect is on the video distribution platforms, whether it's Skype or Netflix or YouTube or Hulu, and what we should be asking is, number one, like, what are they already doing today? They're already spending a lot of money to make sure that they can provide capacity. Sometimes they get it wrong. Netflix started having slower streaming last year because prematurely started allowing higher streaming quality that made the streaming on their networks slow down for everybody, right? So that was a business mistake. They needed more capacity to do that. So that's the first question. Are they already paying? And the second question is, do we actually make consumers off by either banning direct deals with ISPs, which is what some people seem to be proposing, or heavily regulating them? And my point is, got a better deal by negotiating directly with Comcast than they would have gotten through some other provider like Cogent or Level 3. And there are ways of dealing, policing those relationships through law, like the antitrust laws and the FCC's power, even without formal rules about that. But also there is competitive discipline. Again, there's another market where they have Comcast can't charge more than Level 3 or Cogent would for the same service. And Comcast has an incentive, again, to make sure that those customers switch to a viable option don't do so. So that's what we should be talking about, is how do we make that broad competition work even better?
Yeah, and let me add to Barron's point that, look, there is no scenario where everybody is going to have equal speed on the internet. Now and then, unfortunately, some of the net neutrality advocates have said where every website will load at the same speed or what have you. But people buy different levels of access. I might only be willing to pay for a server that gives me a certain minimal amount of bandwidth. There's no scenario that in which I, as a guy working out of my house, am going to purchase servers that are right in the major population locations all around the world where people might get my content. But there's nothing illegal with that. That is simply buying geographic access. So there's nothing wrong with different levels of speed. A number of years ago, Al Franken, I think it was, said, how long do you think it will take before Fox News website loads 5 times faster than Daily Kos? So a network engineer friend of mine actually checked it and found that Daily Kos loads about twice as fast as the FoxNews.com website right now. That's simply a matter of, you know, how many hops something has to take through the network access they're buying, the servers they're using. There's a lot of different things that affect that. And so I think we need to get over the idea that everything is going to be equal everywhere, regardless of price, because at the end of the day, if I have $1 billion, I can probably buy more servers than you can.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it goes to the question that I've had in the back of my mind here as we've gone through this discussion, and that is a couple of times you've raised the issue that there are laws and processes in place where if anything were to veer severely awry, that could be corrected. Could you give us some examples, and I'll start with you, Barron, on what would look broken enough to have a regulator or an agency come and fix?
Well, look, if you had a situation, are you talking about peer on the back end?
I'm talking about abuses of either market power or entering into arrangements, private arrangements that would unfairly disadvantage the market such that it would warrant a regulator or an agency to step in.
So apparently my audio is bad, so I apologize for that. That is in fact because I'm using Wi-Fi here at home between my computer and the router. So that it's just to say a lot of these problems exist at the user level. They're not necessarily network problems. So I apologize for that. But just to answer your question, the antitrust analysis on this is a pretty sound one. It asks whether there's whether there's forfeiture. If Comcast is doing something to Netflix that forces its ability to compete, that's an antitrust violation. So just for example, I mean, you could imagine a world, a different world, where Comcast had set its basic data tier at 50 or let's even 20 gigabytes per month, and then charged instead of $10 for extra gigabyte increments, charged $20 or $30 for that. Right? You could imagine that significantly deterring people from streaming Netflix. because it would just be too expensive to pay for the data. But they haven't done that. They set their basic data tier at 300 gigabytes, which has been increasing over time and is probably likely to increase. And at that rate, it's hard to see how anybody's discouraged from relying on Netflix video and cutting the cord to Comcast cable product. So that would just be one example of the analysis and where I think it's probably working today. That is, you know, antitrust law doesn't require an enforcement action or a regulation. It can be working today just because that incentive is there, that on top of all the market incentives, that discourages Comcast from hurting Netflix.
John, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I think Barron can cover that far better than I do.
Okay. My other question... Go ahead.
Denise, if I just add, I mean, so that's the antitrust analysis. The FCC, as I keep saying, can, without actually crossing that line of common carriage, can require that deals be reasonable and non-discriminatory. And I, you know, that can mean a wide range of different things. But the point is that the FCC today has a lot of power. There's a myth out there that there's no cop. Susan Crawford and others say that a lot. That's just not true. There are three cops, the Federal Trade Commission, Department of Justice, enforcing the antitrust laws. And then there's the FCC, which has broad power now under Section 706 and can deal with these concerns. It has ways of dealing with access and program carriage concerns about the Time Warner Cable merger. There's a lot that can be done today, but there's a certain constituency out there that has always wanted for broadband to be as a Title II common carrier. And they're saying right now that that's the only way that the FCC can act to protect consumers. And while it's true that there are some differences at the margin the FCC can do, it's just not true that the FCC is powerless without reclassification. And I would say reclassification would be a very bad thing for a faster internet service, because it means treating broadband providers as politicians. And even if you say that you're going to forbear from the most onerous parts Title II price controls, you're still going to chill investment. That process is taking years to play out at the FCC and in the courts. And and his chairmanship on reclassification, if that's what he decides to do, spending it on things like all of the great objectives in the National Broadband Plan, which were all about promoting broadband deployment and open more spectrum to make wireless better.
Let's look at the question of wireless versus wired and how the open internet rule, when it was in effect, only affected wired broadband, and that wireless is out of that picture altogether. And I'm wondering, John, you know, what the policy reasons are behind that. Is it because, you know, so few of us get our internet delivered to our homes and businesses through a wireless process at this point that, you know, there's even more incentive to have a hands-off approach there? Is that what's going on, or is there something else in play?
Well, there's a few things. First of all, let me say, I think the advocates of net neutrality have a better philosophical case for open access or net neutrality in terms of wireless, because it is a public resource. It is a public good or a commons in some ways, much more so than a particular bit of wire, which is created and laid by a private provider is. That said, they have a much more difficult technical case. The market is more competitive in the wireless space. The technical limitations of wireless are far, far greater than in wired broadband. You can very easily overload a router, you know, with a few people using P2P, or not a router, a tower, with a few people using peer-to-peer around a tower. It's the limitations on that are much more significant than they are with wired, or at least significant relative to the issue of net neutrality. So there's going to be a little bit more leeway given just from a pure technical and competition perspective. But also what the FCC said was that the market is still younger and developing, and they want to wait and see before trying to impose rules that lock it into a form.
Baron, we're talking about why the open internet order only applied to wired broadband and not wireless, and what the implications of that are.
Okay.
Do you have any comments on that?
The FCC, John probably already said this, but the FCC tried to recognize the capacity constraints, that the net capacity problem, as I put it, is much, much greater on the wireless networks. I'm sure that they'll have to revisit that question. I would say this, in a way, what's really telling about that is that the FCC felt compelled to do that because the approach they were taking was so rigid. They were really trying to ban a secondary market regarding network management that they felt they couldn't apply it to wireless. You could certainly imagine that the antitrust rules, for example, apply across the board. They don't make those distinctions, and you could imagine that a more flexible rule that really focused on real problems could be applied across the board. This would just play out differently on wireless and wireline. So we'll see. I think the one thing worth pointing out is that we're starting to see the analog to what we've been talking about regarding peering and Netflix has started to play out on the wireless side, with AT&T proposing a sponsored data program where they will allow certain content, or any content provider, frankly, it's an open API, anybody can participate, who can pay for user data on wireless networks. And that's already been decried as a net neutrality violation, even though that could really go a long way to helping to solve the capacity problem that makes video streaming very difficult on wireless networks.
So Scott Michaud in IRC is pushing back on the notion that small businesses or individuals might not want to create their own video distribution servers. Why wouldn't you want to be your own video distribution server if you had the resources to do it and the technical know-how? Our network does not, as you were pointing out, we do use third parties. We use Justin TV and Ustream, but we could, and at some point, may choose to do that if we feel that the third parties are either inefficient or too expensive or not delivering what we want. And I think there is the case to be made that that niche of the market should be encouraged rather than discouraged. So what do you respond to Scott, Baron?
Yeah, I'm not saying that, the only video distributors we should have are the ones that exist today. All I'm saying is, as a basic technical and economic matter, it's just not cost effective for everyone to build their own video distribution platform. I mean, it's not a simple matter. It has taken Google literally billions of dollars to provide the basic back end that makes YouTube work, and even still, YouTube doesn't stream everything at HD quality. And if they did, it would cause a huge catastrophe for everybody. I mean, video, I can't underscore this point enough. Getting high quality video through the internet means that you got to make the back end really, you used the word messy earlier, you got to build a lot of hardware on the back end, and that takes an enormous amount of money. So to imagine that we're going to have 100 or 1,000 or more independent video distribution platforms just isn't realistic. So what we really need to be asking about is, so given that we're going to have a relatively small number, and given that some companies may really want to add and join that sort of system, what's the problem? And I'll just give you a concrete example. This happened last year. Intel wanted to start offering an over-the-top video service. And Intel, despite having enormous resources and enormous technical know-how, they decided not to do it. And the reason wasn't net neutrality. It wasn't the cost of the infrastructure or the hardware. They knew, well, they could do all that stuff. The issue was the content rights. They have the same problem that the cable systems have, which is that the real market power is with people who produce the stuff that we all want to watch. And that's most of all sports, but it's a few premium properties like HBO as well. Those are the people that really have the market power. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. That's good stuff. It's good that, you know, people want it. The really interesting thing I think is starting to happen in that market is you're seeing that companies like Netflix are themselves getting into the content creation business. So they are vertically integrating in the same way that cable companies have been in the past. And you know, that just sort of illustrates how competition works in this market. And that's not something that we should be afraid of, but it's just to say that this is, A, hard to do, takes a lot of money, and B, is going to require some form of a vertical integration to some degree. And, you know, that the level of analysis here shouldn't be, are we having 1,000 video distribution platforms, or can people get the content that they want? And if they can't, it's probably because of the content owners, not because of anybody in the middle.
Okay, we've had Susan Crawford on the show before. We've had Nilay Patel on the show many times. Susan was last on right when the FCC Verizon case had been argued, and had a lot of good comments about the case and her take on it. Nilay and Susan are both in the camp that broadband services should be classified as a comm carrier. And that's as you mentioned, Baron, that's how the FCC should go on this. And what's strange to me about these arguments back and forth on that particular point is that there's, you know, a decision to be made. It seems to me like it either is or it isn't. You know, broadband is a common carrier or isn't a common carrier. And there really shouldn't be a whole lot of indecision on that point. So I'm interested from Baron and John to know, I'm guessing that you both think it shouldn't be classified as a common carrier, and why that's such a clear case in your mind, Baron?
Yeah, let me just start by saying that, you know, the reason that we have the internet of today at all is precisely because broadband wasn't classified as a common carrier. I mean, it was in 1992, people don't realize this, so the Cable Act initially put all kinds of restrictions on cable companies, stopped telcos from competing as well. And that delayed broadband deployment for years in this country. What finally unleashed it was not just the 1996 Cable Act, but the decisions beginning with the Clinton administration to take a light touch approach to regulating broadband providers. And what that meant was, instead of imposing the traditional regulatory model, which assumed that there was going to be a monopoly and therefore was sort of self-fulfilling, instead, we had a light touch approach that led to $300 billion being put into broadband infrastructure, right? That's the infrastructure that makes it possible for you to get the speeds that you get today. And you may not think that they're fast enough, but if we'd actually had reclassified years ago, the internet would be slower. You wouldn't have video distribution the way that we have today. And people who say that, well, we can just reclassify, but forbear from the most onerous parts of Title II, they just don't understand how the process works. It's just not that simple. The FCC, if they forbear from anything, that is another lengthy process that gets tied up years in litigation, and inevitably so. Even if we all agreed on what the deal was going to be, somebody out there who wanted broadband to be more regulated would fight in court. So reclassification has just never been a realistic option. The Obama administration put heavy pressure on the FCC in 2010 when it even floated the idea not to do it. It was opposed by 74 House Democrats. It's something that really runs in the face of 15 years of bipartisan industrial policy to promote broadband in this country. And so to have people like Susan on the one hand say that broadband isn't fast enough, and then say that we should reclassify broadband, the only way that you really square those two things together is if you have the government take over running the broadband networks, which is what Susan wants. She wants local governments to build those networks. And we don't have any reason to think that they're going to do a good job of that, either building them or making sure that they actually keep up the capacity that you need to run things like high-speed video.
You know, let me add that the question of reclassification to Title II is, you know, I understand that there are arguments for it, but remember, Title II involves a lot more than just saying the net shall be neutral, a lot more than just these basic common carrier that you have to take all comers obligations. There are an enormous number of obligations, which is why when the FCC floated the idea of Title II reclassification in 2010, they said, well, Title II, but we'll forbear from 40 of the items within Title II. And then a week later, they came back and said, wait, we'll forbear from 41 of the items within Title II, which should give you a sense of, you know, how much you can trust an agency to enforce or not enforce some of these things. They can't commit future agencies to also do that. So if you like Title II, bear in mind that it's going to come a lot with come in with a lot of other obligations that A, are going to be legally controversial, as Barron said, and B, are not going to necessarily be just the common carrier rule that you like.
I don't know if I like or dislike it. It just seems to me strange that in this context, there's so much debate around what box you put broadband in. You know, it seems to me like it should be more clear cut, and that the debate is all about politics and, as you were alluding to just then, John, horse trading. Okay, well, we'll put it in this box, but we won't apply all the factors that might come into play, and maybe a future version of our agency will. It just seems, go ahead.
A lot of this debate is really fundamental. It comes down to a debate over whether the internet and broadband access should be a public utility or not. And I understand there are arguments on both sides, but from our perspective, it doesn't need to be a public utility because that's going to be a monopoly. So we would like to see more competition, and that's not going to happen if it's a public utility. And what happens with public utility monopolies? I mean, how much innovation have you seen out of the electric system in the last 80 years? Competition is difficult with that. You're not going to see as much innovation out of a public utility monopoly. You can certainly understand that the government might be able to, if it concerts resources on something, especially if it controls access to the right-of-way, the government might be able to build something relatively quickly and easily. But what is their incentive and motivation for upgrading it, for trying new services, for doing things very differently? In many cases, the public utility broadbands are not actually less expensive than the existing private providers. In some cases, they are, but you know, that's what you would expect if you get massive federal subsidies to build a network, or if you are building a network over top of existing utility networks, and you don't have to jump through all the hoops that private providers are going to. So it is to some extent a question of whether we want to treat it like the electric system or to treat it like we treat roads. You know, Barron and I take the view that the road is not the fiber. The road is the right-of-way. The right-of-way is what people should have easy access to, whereas if we treat the fiber as the road, we're just embedding a monopoly.
Now, let me just elaborate on that point, because people don't really understand this. So part of the reason that cable companies had to spend $300 billion to build out broadband was they had to dig up every street in America, really, to roll out broadband to homes. And what should have been done at the time, and what we're saying should be done now, what 25 House Democrats proposed in the last Congress, was what was called a dig once policy, which is the idea that when you dig up the road, for whatever reason, anytime you do a road project, you should put in there underneath the road a conduit that anybody can put a fiber cable through. That idea is actually supported even by the cable industry. That would be great for everybody. It increases the cost of a roads project by about 1%, but it makes it about 90% cheaper to deploy a new network. And our point is that there are some things here that really are natural monopolies, but it's not. It doesn't have to be the broadband network. It's that tube, that system of conduits, the tubes that run under the streets. That's a natural monopoly. The utility towers, the poles around the city, that's a monopoly that is either owned by the city or that is a monopoly license by the city. So you know, we're not saying that there's no role for government. I'm fine with having a non-discriminatory pricing regime for either the public infrastructure, or if AT&T has towers in Austin and the government has licensed those towers and nobody else is going to be able to put up towers, fine. Let's have non-discriminatory pricing so that Google Fiber can roll out in Austin. But if we deal with those problems, what we see is that broadband isn't just not a natural monopoly. I'm just astonished that people like Susan Crawford keep saying that, even the very week that Google Fiber finally proves that what they're doing is not a stunt, that they're willing to roll out in cities that are feasible for them to do so. So again, we could have real competition here if we just both deregulated at the local level and had some smarter infrastructure policy that used concepts like Dig One. And Google and CenturyLink and Verizon have already laid out exactly what cities need to do in those respects. And that would be a much better way to serve consumers than simply letting local governments build government networks. And I mentioned this earlier, but it's not as simple as just building the network. You got to keep operating it and keep providing capacity. So even Google Fiber, for example, still only offers Netflix streaming rates at like 1/300th of the theoretical maximum speed, because the problem is the back end capacity. And I worry, and John worries, that even if you sank a lot of government money into building out a broadband network that was, you know, had a high speed at the local level, it's still not necessarily going to be a very good network or keep up things that consumers want to do with it over the years. Now, those are the kind of things that private companies tend to do. So we should be really removing obstacles for private investment and for competition at that layer. As to your point about reclassification, Denise, you asked why it's a hard question. I mean, I should just say, in connection with this point I was just making, traditional common carriers were not forced to be carriers. They wanted to be common carriers because they got a monopoly, right? That was the deal. The concepts go hand in hand. But if you're not going to get to be a monopoly, if you've got competitors, you don't want to be a common carrier. You don't want to have your rates controlled by government. You want a competitor. Now, you might try to keep out competitors through other means, like making for them to deploy. But those are the problems we should deal with. The reclassification thing is really just it's a red herring. It's something that the FCC, legally speaking, do, but politically is never going to happen, because you know even Democrats in D.C. oppose it. So we need to really just focus on what can the FCC do and what should it do with the world that exists now and with the power that it has under Section 706.
Again, I'm going to refer people to this week's episode of This Week in Google. There was a good discussion of whether or not municipalities should become the broadband provider, and as an alternative to the private options that we have now. That's episode 238 of This Week in Google, and it's called Net Brutality. And Evan, on this topic, do you think that it has to be an either or? Should municipalities and government be able to play in this game, and might not they be able to accomplish things that private enterprise can't simply because of their resources? You know, as they pointed out on Twig, we don't have private enterprise build our roads and other infrastructures except as directed in a government project. So what do you think of that?
The best thing I could see a local municipality doing in this space is cooperating with the NSA and the Department of Homeland Security in seeing the contents of all of our communications and further eroding our Fourth Amendment.
That would never happen, surely.
No. I mean, I can't believe people even will entertain the notion of the government providing this much infrastructure. The world is a frightening enough place the way it is when it comes to the government watching what we're doing. You look at some of the surveillance cases in meat space, you know, the Jones case, GPS tracking somebody around on the roads. It just seems even weirder to think that you'd have the government providing that to just give that entree into expanding with so much more ease, that kind of surveillance. I just can't get that issue out of my mind. And that, apart from the market concerns and all all the issues that we've been talking about so far here, I wouldn't want to touch government, whether it be a local municipality or whatever, provided internet for those reasons that, the privacy and the civil liberties reasons. But if I'm oversimplifying it, I would love to have somebody help me be more at ease.
What do you think, Baron? Could it be, does it have to be an either or? Couldn't we have both players in the game?
Look, I'm not going to get hung up on whether states really should ban municipalities from building broadband networks, which is what some states have done now and what mm-hmm. some people are so upset about. I think it is it seems very likely to me that when the government competes with the private sector, that it drives out private investment and that consumers will be worse off. But it's an empirical question. I could be wrong. Well, I'm more concerned with making sure that private companies have the option of rolling out. I mean, John mentioned that one of the reasons that municipal broadband has succeeded anywhere, if it has, it's not just the subsidies that they've gotten. It's that they get to end run all the local BS because, you know, like in Chattanooga, it's actually the local utility that's running the network. So they skip right ahead. They don't have to deal with what Google Fiber has to deal with. So we can have all those advantages, right? We could have a Google Fiber be able to take advantage of using the poles that the utility company owns on a fair, non-discriminatory priced basis, without taxpayers having to spend any money other than maybe that 1% of the roads project concept that I mentioned of doing dig once. So I just think if you look at the numbers, it's hard to see why you'd want local government putting bonds out and spending money that really could be spent on teachers and policemen's pensions and salaries, when a private company could be willing to build and run the network and the local government has to do nothing more than get out of the way and maybe spend a little bit of money on building those conduits that they can then rent and make money off of. That's the natural monopoly. That's where we should be focused on having smarter policy.
Okay. Before we leave this topic of net neutrality and the FCC's power in the wake of the Verizon decision. This is one of those instances where I was really chomping down my Wheaties following your Twitter streams this week. And it has to do with a study of news organizations that the FCC sponsored. Can you tell us what went on there and how the fairness doctrine comes into play and how it illustrates, I think you both might say, the expanded powers of the FCC and where they might go. Can we start with you, Baron?
Yeah, sure. So a few years ago, the FCC started an inquiry into critical information needs, and now they put out a new study they proposed last year. And this has all been done at the staff level. The commission never actually voted on this, even what raises some pretty significant First Amendment concerns. And the bottom line is this: instead of having a researcher sit down and study hard data on what topics are discussed on the news and so on, and then analyze it, a big data approach, which I would be fine with. Instead, what they proposed to do was to send researchers in who everybody would know were from the FCC to go ask broadcasters all kinds of intrusive questions about what they cover, why they cover it, whether there are disputes between journalists and editors. That's the kind of thing that the free speech community has always been worried about. When the government goes in and starts asking people questions like that, it has a chilling effect. And it doesn't matter how good your intentions are, whether you're doing it to try to discourage bias, you end up shaping the way that media works, especially because we're talking about broadcasters who have a license that the FCC can take away at any point. So anyway, the bottom line is that is deeply concerning, and it was something that one of the FCC commissioners, Ajit Pai, voiced great concern about in the Wall Street Journal because he was never given the chance to vote on it or helped the study or suggest that it be done in a less intrusive way that doesn't actually change the data. And And he got some pushback for that. But the analogy to the fairness doctrine is that the FCC used to require that if you get talked about a controversial subject on radio, you had to have someone on to present the other side. And what that actually effectively did was somewhat similar. It had the unintentional effect of chilling discussion of controversial topics because you get tied up in litigation about whether you gave someone the right to respond, who was the right person, so on. And it's just to say that the point in either case is not that the FCC sets out to censor or control media, but that that is the effect of their regulation. That has always been the message of the free speech community. And now what you're really seeing is principled free speech advocates are standing by that. And then some people who, are frankly are not that principled are now saying that somehow the FCC doesn't care about media bias. So they're getting confused about this.
Okay, John, anything to add?
Well, the FCC did a really good report back in 2008 on the details around licensing and public interest and communications needs, information needs of communities and that sort of thing. And one of the points they made was that the commission can't dictate to licensees what programming they have to air, and they leave it to licensees to determine what the information needs of their communities are, and that the FCC does not substitute their judgment for the judgment of the licensees, which is a bit of a circular argument that they are to oversee that communities are getting the information they need, but they ask the licensees what the information they need is, and then just take the licensee's word for it, because the licensee is going to say whatever they are providing is what the community needs. Which, on one hand, that's a bit circular. On the other hand, there's not really another way around that. If the FCC in any way, shape, or form tries to impose its judgment on what the information needs of a community actually are, then you immediately trump right into First Amendment territory. And the problem is, as Barron can explain better than I can, but the problem is that there are many who believe that the First Amendment is a sword, not a shield, and that the government may not curtail speech, but that the government may promote the speech that it finds useful and helpful. And so a lot of the concern on the right is that while the left has certainly forsworn, and I certainly believe that fairness doctrine is dead letter, it's not coming back, it's not a threat, that doesn't mean that content regulation or tinkering with the inputs of content is not still a threat. I mean, if you don't have to say what has to come out of the air, you can say who owns the licenses, and you can certainly shape the market that way, or providing more public media is certainly a way to affect the media market. So the concern from the right and the free market community is not that the FCC is going to go in and tell them, you have to push this, you may not push this. It's that they will use more of the levers of regulatory power.
Okay, we had a bunch of copyright stories we could discuss this week. There's a lot going on, some interesting developments and decisions and updates to things we've been following. I think we're pretty much going to shelve them because we are having such a good time and a good discussion on the issues we've been pursuing. But there is a copyright wrinkle that Jeff Jarvis brought up on Twig that I'd love to get your guys' take on. And that is, he suggested that one of the reasons that we have such trouble with video distribution and why it's such an issue and a tax on the network is because of our copyright laws and the way that they artificially constrain the way that video is delivered, because Netflix can't do something like utilize P2P because that wouldn't take into account the copy protection that is necessary for them to be able to carry the videos that they do. And I'm wondering, I thought that was a really interesting insight, and I'm wondering if you guys think that copyright reform might be helpful in unraveling and smoothing out some of these video distribution problems that we've been discussing today. What do you think, Barron?
Well, yes and no. I'm very much such a pragmatist on copyright. I've been critical of things like SOPA, but you know, at the end of the day, what copyright does well, but by protecting HBO or the House of Cards, you know, you wouldn't have content like that. It wouldn't be of the same quality if we didn't protect those copyrights. So that's where I'm all in favor of copyright. And, you know, frankly, at the end of the day, those copyright owners, you know, they're going to charge for that content what they think it's worth. And that may drive up cable costs. It may be a problem for video distributors. But you know, that's a sign that people want that content. Now, where I'm very sympathetic to what Jeff might be saying is that on top of those basic protections, which I think most of us would probably agree on, well, about, there's another set of restrictions in the video marketplace that are, I would say, quasi-copyright. And those are all of the things that regulate content distribution at the level of broadcast content. So this Aereo case, for example, whatever you think about it, it's really an example of companies trying to innovate their way around that bizarre set of rules around broadcasting. Mm-hmm. And that set of rules is it's on its way out. Either the Aereo case is going to kill it because Aereo wins, and then the networks say, well, you know, if you can just take our content, if it's put up on broadcast, we're just going to stop putting it on broadcast. We're going to become a cable network. Goodbye. Or you're going to see Congress finally change those rules. And I think that would certainly help, that there is, to a degree, that there is a problem there where that's driving up the price of broadcast content. But that's not the biggest part of why cable costs are high or why it's hard for over-the-top video distributors to compete. It really gets down to things like sports. Sports content is the number one biggest, most economists would say, demand insensitive, inelastic form of content out there. People are willing to pay a huge amount of money for it, and that creates market power. So I think the answer, to make a long story short, is that copyright isn't the problem. If you're concerned about exclusive dealings or program access and program carriage, we already have rules that deal with those. We could tweak them. The NBC Universal deal put some restrictions on Comcast there, and you'll probably see conditions in Comcast, Time Warner Cable in that deal that will govern how Comcast licenses its own content, like NBC. And there's certainly a way that could be done to help online video distributors get access to that content. But I don't really see it as fundamentally a copyright problem, unless you go so far as to do the sort of thing you alluded to of actually shutting down peer-to-peer networks that really could be used to distribute video more effectively. I certainly wouldn't support that, but that's not really a copyright problem, or that's not something that you have to do to defend legitimate copyrights.
Yeah, no, I wasn't hoping to shut them down, but rather whether, you know, if we're looking at efficiencies and, you know, trying to come up with a legal structure that doesn't make people try and route around copyright law, but respects that, you know, we want the most efficient possible distribution system in place, that P2P might be something that should be more widely in use.
You mean as a distribution technology?
Exactly.
Well, you know, look, if it made sense, I believe Vimeo uses P2P. I could be wrong, but it's a technical question. It's another technology that might work well, might not, and the market will ultimately sort that out. We'll see what happens.
It's sort of hamstrung by the fact that Netflix would not be able to provide all of the thousands of titles it does if it were to alter its architecture and try and distribute that way. You know, the rights holders would say, sorry, that's just not going to cut it for us.
Well, hold on. I mean, you can run a video platform today using P2P on the back end in a way that is invisible to users. In other words, using P2P doesn't mean you put everything up on BitTorrent. BitTorrent is just one P2P system. So that's just a technology, and I'm all in favor of companies being free to pick the right technology. But, you know, Netflix If they use a technology that just makes video available to everybody, of course content owners are going to be reluctant. I mean, look, the situation we're in today is very similar to the situation we were in with music, where the music labels fought tooth and nail against online distribution. And eventually what it took was Apple, which had enough market power to force them to come to the table and cut a deal and be willing to put their stuff up on iTunes, right? We're basically in a similar situation today. That's going to change over time. And quite frankly, it's probably maybe more likely to change if you have a bigger programmer, cable company that's willing to go head-to-head with the programmers. The only thing you should really be concerned about there is vertical integration. So if it were true that Comcast owned a huge number of cable programmers, that might be a problem. But that percentage, that affiliation number, has plummeted from being in the 90% range in the 1990s to today being something like 15%. So that's just not – it doesn't seem to me to be a big concern, and we can deal with that with merger conditions and specific rules.
Okay,
you know,
John,
I would also add that,
go ahead.
Yeah, I would add that, BitTorrent is not just the software. It's also a for-profit company that is distinct from the software, but the for-profit company does not engage in piracy or trading files illegally. They do provide BitTorrent as a service to many media companies. I know NBC was using it some years ago. So, you know, whether it gets used or not is not really simply about media companies being unwilling to use something that is often associated with piracy. The media companies will use it if it's going to be effective. But we have to remember that the right of the media companies is not just a right of Hollywood or big media companies. It's also the right of small guys, whoever not only sells their content to the bigger media companies, but distributes their contents individually. So, you know, the right of the creator, whether big or small, to engage in a transaction or not is equally important to the right of the consumer to use their content how they want, to do with their content what they want, to be able to get access to content. It's a bilateral relationship. You know, and those things will work out. It happens slowly because the business models are changing. And as much as people say, well, they should just drop their old business models and adopt new business models, that's hard. I remember sitting down with for a senior person in the music industry a number of years ago, and he showed me a PowerPoint slide and said, look, we get that cassettes are gone. CD sales are almost gone. We get that the market is dramatically changing. The question isn't, do we change? The question is, what business model is going to work? And right now, it's not like we can all just hop to a different business model. Everybody's experimenting, and they're trying to experiment without completely losing the current revenues they have, the things they have that are working right now. So, you know, these things will happen, but it has to be evolutionary. If we tried to force it through with some massive copyright reform, and some copyright reforms are good, but if we try to force it through with a massive copyright reform, it would end up not being as innovative an evolution as it can be, while if we still protect copyrights and contents in that evolution.
Do you agree, Evan?
Yeah, I mean, that all seems really sensible. We can't just throw out the whole model and expect a new one to appear overnight that's going to continue to support an industry, an entertainment industry, as robust as what it is now. I mean, copyright reform is needed, and there are some areas where it's clear where it has its weaknesses. And, you know, like, for example, the statutory damages model. We've talked about this before. Anything that's going to motivate trollish behavior on the part of copyright owners, that's something that needs to go away. And so I think the new models need to be given enough time to make themselves known, and the revenue streams that the copyright industry will enjoy from those will arise and exist in that new environment. It reminds me a little bit about what we were talking about earlier with, the deal with Netflix and Comcast. It's just really interesting if you step back and look at this larger perspective. You know, Netflix has been enabled to move into a streaming content service because of broadband networks. And so now it has, you know, that's the environment in which it has been allowed to grow. And now it's running up against some problems there, some growing pains, if you will. It's why it's striking these new deals. So I think just at a general level, it's really interesting to see how these technologies interact with one another and how distribution models affect norms and how businesses and revenue streams will develop around that. You just got to allow some patience, as John is suggesting, and there needs to be an emphasis on a certain amount of equilibrium while changes do take place. That it can't be too drastic, or else there will be weakness, and the system could fall apart.
Yeah, Denise, someone on the IRC channel used my favorite line, that the future is already here. It's just not very evenly distributed yet.
Yes.
What we're really seeing is, you know, these are all really hard things. Sorting out the content rights, figuring out how much capacity you need. It's always going to be a messy process. It's always going to take time to play out. And there are always going to be people who are jumping up and down saying that it could be better if the government just did X. And our message, just to bring this full circle, you asked me what tech freedom does. Mm-hmm. Our message really is that there are often things that the government should do. They usually involve getting out of the way, like getting out of the way of local broadband deployment. Sometimes they're about smarter infrastructure, like dig once. But usually things will turn out fine if we just let the companies involved sort them out on their own. If there are problems, we deal with them as they arise. That's why antitrust law is generally a better approach. That's why it's not a good idea to write in place preemptive rules that ban an entire sort of business practice, as the FCC tried to do with its original net neutrality rules. So we're for letting this stuff all play out in all of its messiness. That's what Virginia Pistrell once called dynamism. It's a willingness to deal with that unplanability of the future and not make it conform to a nice, simple, neat plan or a metaphor or like Mission Superhighway. It's never going to be that simple. So we're going to keep having this kind of discussion forever, because we're never going to get to the point where it's done and everything just works, which is what, you know, a lot of us techie geeks want. We imagine that eventually we'll reach a state when, you know, video is easy and everything is smooth and nobody needs to really innovate anymore. There's never going to be a static state like that.
Yeah. David Weinberger wrote years ago that the reason the internet works is because it's fundamentally broken. And I'm paraphrasing him, but that's his crux in his book, Small Pieces Loosely Joined. And I think I get what he was after there. I'm going to move one of our stories that we had as a trademark/free speech discussion up to our tip of the week, because I think we'll go ahead and do a few tips and a resource of the week to close out the show. The story I have in mind, getting back to Evan's concerns about the NSA, is if you too are concerned about the NSA, or somebody who likes to spotlight issues around the NSA, perhaps you are anxious to parody their logos. There is an individual who got involved in a lawsuit with both the DHS and NSA about that very thing, was offering mugs and things. And if you want to parody the NSA or the DHS on a t-shirt or a mug, good news for you. You can do that because after a 3-year legal battle, there are some cease and desist letters that were served by the NSA and DHS were found to be not in order, and that you can go ahead and parody their logos to your heart's content. So it was Tim Cushing over at Tech Dirt who has a nice piece on that. If you'd like some more information, if you'd like to see that story or any of the other stories that we've been discussing today, head on over to delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/248, and there will be links to everything we've discussed and more. A couple more great tips from just our cruising through the internet this week. A piece at the Wall Street Journal over secret apps. Things like Whisper Secret and Ask.fm that people are using to be able to share their souls in and their perhaps embarrassing or nefarious activities in a way that they would not on a less secure channel such as Facebook or Twitter, that these apps are out there encouraging people to do that. But of course, the Wall Street Journal wants you to be cautious about that. Author of this article points out it's important for everyone to understand what might be recorded and to weigh the consequences if your secrets fall into the wrong hands. So be skeptical about using secret apps. And then I thought it was pretty funny. Another little copyright story here. There's a viral video out there, if you haven't seen it yet, that is made by the SPCA of Wake County. It's a lip dub. It features an ABBA song, If You Change Your Mind, that one. And, you know, goes through the SPCA with lots of adorable animals. It's a very well done lip dub. And I guess it's a couple of years old. Somehow, inexplicably, it's had a surge of popularity again. It's had over 65,000 views online. And of course, who doesn't like the SPCA and adorable animals? Well, ABBA doesn't like so much that their song was used and is attempting to DMCA the video. Of course, there are various versions of it out there, and their DMCA efforts are not all that effective. So the tip we're deriving from this is, you know, think twice. This is a Streisand effect kind of tip. If you are a rights holder and you have a very sympathetic entity like the SPCA and adorable puppies and kittens, that might not be the best instance for you to exercise your rights for just purely from a public relations standpoint. And then Evan has our resource of the week, which is SheStock Images. Can you tell us about that, Evan?
Sure, yes. A former colleague of mine at my old firm has co-founded a new company called SheStock Images. This is really, it's two parts. It's a source of stock images, and it's also, I guess what the best way of describing it is, a network almost, where you can, where purchasers of stock photos can buy particular assignments of stock photos. And the whole motif, the thing that makes this special and unique, is this fits in with the current narrative that we're hearing a lot of and this is to use the words from the SheStock site, helping companies fix their failed dialogue with women through professional women photographers and portraying women in stock photography in a positive light. You know, we've seen some activity on this front with, you know, from Sheryl Sandberg starting, you know, partnering with Getty Images to come up with leanin.org, portraying women in a more positive or just a more realistic light, perhaps. You know, we've seen parodies of the ill ways in which this communication has been made. You know, there's that Tumblr. I think it's now defunct. I mean, it's still there, but I don't think it's a new content. Something like women
eating salad.
Yeah,
women laughing and eating salad.
Yes, that whole thing. You know, it's the counter to that. So SheStock is a new resource that consumers in this space should check out. And the reason that I'm interested in it is because my former colleague Christopher Borders is one of the co-founders of it, and I would really like to see. You know, I'm not a paid sponsor or anything like that. It's just my friend who's doing this, but it looks like an exciting project that's going on.
It looks like they have some neat images, and the site is well done. The very first one that I pulled up was a woman laughing eating a hot dog, so not too much.
Not even going to go there.
Yes, exactly. So great. Thank you so much for that, Evan. And thank you so much, John and Baron, for joining us today and having this lengthy and detailed discussion. It's been really, really helpful for me personally, and I'm sure for our listeners and viewers. And we really appreciate your time and your insights. Is there anything that Tech Freedom's up to? John, I'll start with you, or anything you personally are up to that you want to let us know about before we go ahead and wrap the show?
You know, instead of both of us saying what Tech Freedom is up to, I'll let Baron do it. But I will say thank you for having us on, and I hope we've solved the internet. And if we have to come back and do this again, maybe take 2 or 3 weeks to solve all the problems, but I'm sure we can do it.
That's very optimistic. And yes, we appreciate the solutions that we discussed today. Baron, why don't you let us know what's going on with Tech Freedom and anything else that's on your mind?
Sure. Well, as I said at the outset, we spend a lot of time dealing with surveillance and privacy from government snooping. But we like to remind people that's not just about the NSA. It's also about all the law enforcement agencies that can get access to your email to track you, track your location without a warrant. And I just want to call your attention. There was a big push yesterday as part of our ongoing coalition efforts for the Email Privacy Act, which now has 182 sponsors in the House of Representatives. And that would require that law enforcement agencies get a warrant from a judge, convince them that there's probable cause before searching your email. So please check that out. It's H.R. 1852. It's the Email Privacy Act. And that really, if that's going to pass, there's a lot of momentum behind it, but that's got to move soon. We had 100,000 signatures on a whitehouse.gov petition pushing for that, and yet the administration has said nothing about it thus far. So we're really disappointed. And frankly, if that can't get passed, nothing really is going to change on the NSA front, because this really should be a lot easier politically. So that's one thing. Second thing I'll mention, since we talked about the open internet, I would just be remiss if I didn't point out that while I think a lot of the concerns are about net neutrality are a little overblown, there are some very real threats to the open internet on the international stage. And that is specifically that European countries are using concerns about surveillance in the United States as a pretext. They are proposing to create closed networks that will bypass U.S. companies, U.S. servers, in order, they say, to protect the privacy of Europeans. And I have to emphasize that it's really tragic that for all the time and effort that's been spent arguing about the open internet here, no one's paying attention to that. So that's a real problem that could break down the services that we all know and love that are right now global, and that couldn't be if that happened. So we're focused, you already heard, on telecom, net neutrality, opening up broadband competition. There's a lot going on at the FCC right now about opening up more spectrum, about allowing companies like AT&T to transition to all internet services. Those are all things that were bipartisan goals of the 2010 National Broadband Plan. And we're going to keep saying that that's what the FCC should be working on. It's unfortunate that Jenikowski decided he didn't want to do that. But we're pro-deployment, and we're really reaching across the aisle to try to build broad coalitions on that. And then finally, we do also work on a lot of Federal Trade Commission issues, privacy, data protection, competition. Those are getting a lot of attention right now. And we've started a project around FTC reform, which basically asked the question of if the Federal Trade Commission is going to be the default technology regulator, the Federal Technology Commission, if you will, how should it work? And we've outlined a number of proposals in our FTC reform report we put out last year. And you'll see more from us on that. But basically, it means making the FTC a smarter, more technologically sophisticated regulator, but also one that's less likely to jump in and to dictate to Apple, for example, that Apple didn't strike the right balance when they designed the user interface of the iTunes store to leave a 15-minute window open after you made a purchase. And that's exactly what Apple just did, and the FTC decided that they knew better than Apple, that somehow that would allow small numbers of kids to make purchases that their parents didn't know were being made. So that's just an example of the FTC not really being appropriately humble. So that's our work for the year. You can check us out at techfreedom.org, and you've mentioned a few times that we use Twitter pretty heavily, and we're also on Facebook. So please do follow us and reach out to me and John on Twitter or by email if you want to know more. Our email addresses are just our first initial last name at techfreedom.org.
So that's great. Thank you. And the only thing I would add is you're also great at putting together panels and discussions and putting out the video of that, or maybe letting a third party put out the video of that. So for anyone who's interested in more engagement like we've had here today, definitely check in on the Tech Freedom site and follow along. Baron makes an excellent moderator and panelist. And John, I haven't had the pleasure of seeing you in that capacity yet, but I'm sure you do as well. And I really appreciate the way that you guys put together a nice sort of broad spectrum, lots of different viewpoints coming together to hash through issues and try and come to an understanding or solve the internet, as John said, which is obviously all of our goals. And we appreciate your joining us here today for this discussion. If you're joining us live, that means you've done so at Friday. We started at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC, which is when we record every week. So you can join us live at that time, or you can find us after the fact at twit.tv/twill. We've got the whole archive of shows there. We're on YouTube at This Week in Law is our YouTube channel there. Also, we too are on Facebook and on Google Plus. If you want to give us suggestions for guests, further comments on our discussion today or on any of the prior shows, suggestions for topics, things that are on your mind, that would be a great place to go. Also on Twitter, I'm D Howell there. Evan is Internet Cases there. Evan writes the great Internet Cases blog, which you should also check out. And Evan, I'm just glad to be back with you. Missed you guys last week, and it's been so fun chatting today.
Yeah, it has been a lot of fun. It's good to see you back. It's been really fun. As usual, very educational. Lots of really pretty technical things we talked about today. So I've really enjoyed it and really had a good time. Looking forward to next week.
Yeah, and I neglected to put two MCLE passphrases into the show this time around. I'll go ahead and put one in now. Let's make it email privacy. You know, that'll just have to do the job for this time around. The reason we put MCLE passphrases in the show is in case you are interested in getting continuing legal education or other professional credit for the show, which, as I think you could tell, can be actually educational. You can go to your particular bar and apply. We have some information about that at wiki.twit.tv. And let us know how that's going for you. If you are engaged in that, we put the phrases in the show in case you have to demonstrate that you actually watched or listened. Little way of proving that you did. So thanks so much for joining us on this episode of This Week in Law. We'll be back next week. And until then, keep solving the internet. Take care.